fire was in my head, and cut and peeled a hazel wand, and hooked a berry to a thread. And when white moths were on the wing, and moth-like stars were flickering out, I dropped the berry in a stream and caught a little silver trout.
Mother, you'll never guess. I've just been proposed to.
Oh, dear Willie, he said he would. He proposed to me again yesterday.
When I had laid it on the floor, I went to blow the fire aflame, but something rustled on the floor, and someone called me by my name. It had become a glimmering girl with apple blossom in her hair, who called me by my name and ran and faded through the brightening air.
No, Willie. Marriage would be such a dull affair. You make beautiful poetry out of what you call your unhappiness. Poets should never marry. The world will thank me for not marrying you.
Though I am old with wandering through hollow lands and hilly lands, I will find out where she has gone and kiss her lips and take her hands and walk among long dappled grass and pluck till time and times are done the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun.
Now he's proposed to some American girl, and she's accepted him.
I'm glad.
Just after I turned him down.
Perhaps he'll find peace now.
We present The World Will Thank Me by J.P. Rooney, with Barbara Brennan as Maud and Dan Gordon as Yeats.
Oh, I had no illusions when I married Willie Yeats. On that October day in 1917, I knew I was marrying only part of the man. The rest of him was elsewhere. When he proposed to me, he had just returned from Paris, where he had been refused by Maud Gonne McBride for the third time. He certainly deserved full marks for trying. Maud's husband, John McBride, had been shot by the British for his part in the Rising in Dublin in 1916, and she was now a widow and free to marry again, or so he hoped. He even proposed to her daughter, Iseult, a girl half his age, as I myself was at the time. Oh, no, I had no illusions. I was way down the list. But still, I felt honored. Of course, his admiration for Maud Gonne was common knowledge. I knew all that. I had heard all the stories. I had read all the poems, as had everybody.
The first time I saw Maud Gonne, we were both 22, was in January 1889, when she drove up in a hansom to my father's house in London. The troubling of my life had begun.
Good evening. I have an appointment to see Mr. Yeats, Sr. Maud Gonne is my name.
I had never thought to see in a living woman so great beauty. It belonged to famous pictures, to poetry, to some legendary past. A complexion like the blossom of apples, and yet face and body had the beauty of lineaments which Blake calls the highest beauty, because it changes least from youth to age, and a stature so great that she seemed of a divine race. Later she spoke to me, but all I was aware of in the room was that face, that proud look as though she had gazed into the burning sun.
Mr. Yeats? Mr. Yeats?
I'm sorry.
I said it's not just to see your father I came. John O'Leary said he and I would be of one mind on matters affecting our country's welfare, and indeed we were. Though I must say I find him a bit squeamish on the subject of landlords. How do you feel about such matters, Mr. Yeats?
About what, Miss Gonne?
Shooting landlords.
Oh, well, I... It was not possible for a man as young as I was to have differed from someone as beautiful and as young as she.
I agree. Yes. Yes.
Spoken like a true Irishman, Mr. Yeats.
Oh, indeed. Shoot them.
Bravo.
I basked in her approval. If at that moment she had said that the world was flat, I would have been her chief supporter.
But as I was saying, it was not just your father. It was you I hoped to meet as well.
Me, Miss Gonne?
You, Mr. Yeats. Ireland's young rising national poet.
Oh, I'm afraid you exaggerate my achievements.
Oh, no, I think you are doing such marvelous things. All that great work on the old Gaelic myths and legends. Do keep it up. Indeed, you must. I really do feel it is important that Ireland at last will have her own literature, don't you? In my opinion, the Wanderings of Oisin can rival anything that has come from England. I have just finished reading it, and it is the most wonderful, wonderful thing. Oh,
I am delighted you think so.
Our poor oppressed country sorely needs something to lift the spirit of the people. Don't you agree?
Yes. Yes, of course.
Ireland needs people like you, Mr. Yeats. Oh, I and people like me do our best amongst the poor people to bring them some little relief from their misery. But you feed their souls, their imaginations.
Miss Gunn.
It is you who can give them a reason to live.
Miss Gunn.
A reason to lift themselves up from the mud, to stand straight and look the Saxon in the eye.
Miss Gunn.
Yes, Mr. Yeats.
Will you do me the honor of having dinner with me tonight?
And she did. And every night that week that she was in London, he was head over heels in love with her. But he would not speak of it. After all, what could he, a penniless student, offer to one so beautiful, so confident, so independent in thought and in means? She told him of her life of constant travel between Ireland, England, and France, of how she, the daughter of an English colonel born in England but brought up in Ireland from the age of two, had become enraged at the cruelty of the evictions of the starving peasants of Donegal. How she had become a member of the National League for Land Reform, and thereafter a sworn enemy of the British presence in Ireland. He was completely captivated by her, and at the same time so overawed that he could not speak his feelings.
Had I the heavens embroidered cloths, enwrought with golden and silver light, the blue and the dim and the dark cloths of night and light and the half light, I would spread the cloths under your feet. But I, being poor, have only my dreams. I have spread my dreams under your feet. Tread softly, because you tread on my dreams.
He told Maud of his feelings for Ireland, of his spiritual philosophy, of his growing interest in the occult in his quest for belief, subjects also close to her own heart. It was talk, 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 every night into the small hours. Talk, talk, talk for a whole week.
It was to be 18 months before we would meet again. Meet properly, that is. I did see her once, though. A brief 5-minute encounter in October 1889, when, on hearing that she was back in London visiting her sick sister, I rushed round to find her already starting for the boat train on her journey back to France.
Mr. Yeats, how lovely to see you.
Miss Gunn, why didn't you let me know you were in London?
Oh, it was just...
We could have had dinner together, like before. I would have so liked to.
Oh, it would have been lovely, but it was just such a quick visit, just a spur-of-the-moment thing. Please, please excuse me, I am sorry. I am in such a rush. I really do have to go. I will explain sooner, I promise.
But I didn't. Well, not for a long while, anyway. Poor Willie. I was aware of the impression I had made on him at our first meeting, and I could see the hurt in his eyes. It was what I didn't wish to see, yet feared I might. The hurt of a disappointed lover. But how could I tell him the reason why I had hoped to avoid him? Anyway, in the end, he noticed nothing. 3 months later, on the 11th of January, 1890, in Paris, my beloved son, Georgie, was born.
The baby's father was Lucien Millevoye, a French nationalist whom Maud had met at a health spa in France, where both of them were undergoing treatment for lung disorders. They had a common political outlook, he detesting the British Empire almost as much as she, and each had agreed to help the other. However, it became clear to Maud that motherhood and domesticity did not represent the fulfillment she craved. Her soul was restless. For even there in the bourgeois comfort of a Paris suburb, she could hear the voices of the poor and dispossessed of Donegal calling out to her, calling her back over the seas.
I knew what I had to do. And it wasn't easy what I had to do. And there were those that faulted me for it. But I felt a greater call. And against Lucien's protests, I left my beloved baby in the care of a nanny and returned to Ireland. There were those there that needed me more. And it was these people, these poorest of the poor, these people of no property who would one day make Ireland free.
She is foremost of those that I would hear praised. I will talk no more of books or the long wall, but walk by the dry thorn until I have found some beggar sheltering from the wind, and there manage the talk until her name come round. If there be rags enough, he will know her name, and be well pleased remembering it. For in the old days, though she had young men's praise and old men's blame, amongst the poor, both old and young, gave her praise.
It wasn't long before the mists and rains of the west coast of Ireland began to affect her health. Here she spent days trudging over mountains and across bogs, coughing and spitting up blood, sometimes spending nights in the smoke-filled cabins of the starving country people. To them, this tall, beautiful woman trailing her fashionable Parisian clothes in the mud of their cabin floors became a creature of myth.
At Letterkenny, I spent the night at the home of the Bishop of Raphoe. A strikingly handsome man, but I regret his politics were not nearly as dashing as his looks. However, he was entertaining a number of the local priests, most of whom were active in encouraging resistance to the evictions. But they, in the presence of their bishop, were rather discreet, as indeed was I. I wanted to say that landlords should be shot, but then thought better of it in such august company, though I felt a coward afterwards for curbing my tongue.
Lucien wrote to her, pleading with her to come back to France to him and their child, but she resisted. It was only when she heard that a warrant had been issued for her arrest that she returned to France. Here, she began to brood on her relationship. Lucien had tried to get her to become the mistress of a man who could be of political use to him. Despite this, she still loved him. In July, the warrant had been withdrawn for her arrest, and Maud returned to Ireland. By chance, Willie and she were in Dublin at the one time. Learning this, he called to see her at her rooms in Nassau Street.
I was shocked to see her. This was a different Maud. All that haunting beauty gone. Her face lined with ill health and suffering. I was overcome with a wave of pity at the sight of her. Unlike before, she seemed to be vulnerable and needing protection.
You see me changed? Yes, I have changed.
Perhaps you've not quite recovered your health. Your work in Donegal, all that poverty and brutality, perhaps...
Oh, I have witnessed man's inhumanity to man in places other than Donegal. Oh,
my dear Miss Gall, can I help? Is there something...
You are very kind, Mr. Yates.
You know I would do anything to help you.
Yes, I believe you would.
May I then?
Thank you. But there is nothing to be done.
You are very brave.
Brave? No. Stubborn, perhaps. No, each has his own troubles. That's a normal part of life. But what are these personal trifles compared to the sufferings of the poor, Mr. Yates? We must make do with what we've got. Which of us is without some sadness in our lives?
The old, hard confidence was gone. In its place was the gentle indolence of one seeking protection and peace. How I yearned to be that protector. But still I held back what my heart would speak. Next day I set off to visit a friend in County Down and stay for a time, the purpose of my visit to Ireland. After about a week, a letter arrived from Maud, which at once greatly distressed and delighted me. The letter hinted at a great sadness in her life, and this disturbed me greatly. But then she recounted a dream she had just had, where she and I were brother and sister in another life, and that we had been sold into slavery. What could this mean but an acknowledgement of her close feelings towards me? buoyed up with hope, I immediately returned to Dublin.
As he stood there, smiling in the doorway, I knew at once that he had misunderstood my letter. To conceal my alarm, I turned my face away from him and led him into the living room.
Mr. Yates, this is a surprise.
Miss Gone,
I understood you would be away for 2 weeks at least. Surely the weather was not so bad.
Well, Miss Gone,
you can see the place is a mess. Had I some warning?
Miss Gone, I have something to say to you.
I can assure you I don't normally entertain my friends in such... My hand. Mr. Yates, why are you...
Miss Gone, will you do me the honor of becoming my wife?
Mr. Yates...
Maybe I shouldn't have spoken, but I had to. You don't have to give me an answer now. Please, think about it.
Mr. Yates.
I have cared for you deeply since we first met.
And are you, Mr. Yates?
I feel we have so much in common, dare I hope.
But... You know I care for you. But I feel so close to you.
As I do to you, Miss Gone.
But it is the closeness...
Yes.
Of a friend.
A friend?
A very dear friend.
A friend. I see.
Oh, please. I don't want to see that sad face. Mr. Yates, have I hurt you? No, please. I mean what I say. You are so special to me. I really do feel we have been one in another life. I feel as if our souls are one. I have never felt this closeness with another. It is something quite spiritual.
But then surely...
I will be quite open with you, Mr. Yates. There are reasons why I cannot marry, will not ever marry. These are reasons I cannot share with you. But I know I need your very special friendship. Can we not agree to be friends? Can we not? Say we can.
Dear Miss Gone... I had hoped for much more.
For the next few weeks while she remained in Dublin, Willie paid her constant attention, hoping to give her support during this time of private sadness that she was so visibly going through. One day, they went walking by the sea cliffs at Howth when two seagulls flew overhead on their way out to sea.
Aren't they beautiful, Willie? So white, so pure. If I had the choice to be any bird, I think I would want to be one of those.
But would it not be a lonely life, Maud? Just a white speck between the sea and the rocks?
Perhaps. But free. And what a haughty look they have. Don't you envy them their freedom, Willie? Not earthbound like us. Two pure white souls fleeing their earthly prison.
3 days later, he sent her the poem he had just written.
I would that we were, my beloved, white birds on the foam of the sea. We tire of the flame of the meteor before it can fade and flee. And the flame of the blue star of twilight, hung low on the rim of the sky, has awakened in our hearts, my beloved, a sadness that may not die. I am haunted by numberless islands and many a Danann shore, where time would surely forget us, and sorrow come near us no more. Soon far from the rose and the lily, and fret of the flames would we be, were we only white birds, my beloved, buoyed out on the foam of the sea.
And then the blow fell. Calling unexpectedly one day to Maud's rooms, he found her packing her traveling cases in a state of great distress.
I must leave immediately. Please don't question me, Willie. I will write and explain.
But what?
Willie, I said...
But Maud, surely I am due some explanation.
I am so sorry. I have no choice.
But can I help in some way? Please, let me.
All I can tell you is that I have been summoned back to France by a secret society that I belong to. I am oath-bound to obey. Please, don't ask me any more. My baby was dying. My sweet, darling, innocent little boy was dying.
Across 3 countries and 2 seas, I rushed to be with him. On the 31st day of August, he died.
Her sudden departure for France, her subsequent long absence and silence, was a great sorrow to me. But above all else, her refusal of my proposal was an unclosed wound. It was hard to understand. We who had been so close, who had shared so much of our inner feelings. I had thought, and yet this. No one could ever love her more than I. No one. When you are old and gray and full of sleep, and nodding by the fire, take down this book and slowly read and dream of the soft look your eyes had once and of the shadows deep. How many loved your moments of glad grace and loved your beauty with love false or true. But one man loved the pilgrim soul in you and loved the sorrows of your changing face. And bending down beside the glowing bars, murmur a little sadly how love fled, and paced upon the mountains overhead, and hid his face amid a crowd of stars.
Maud's silence was unavoidable. She was wild and incoherent with grief and guilt. At last, however, she wrote,
"My dear Willie, you must forgive me for not writing to you for such a long time. I have been in such deep despair and sadness. A beautiful little child I had adopted here in France, a sweet, adorable little orphan child, has died. He was only 19 months old, and I am consumed with grief. From the start of his illness, I knew he had been called. All night, the death birds were pecking at the nursery window. I knew.
In October, she returned to Ireland, and I met her at Kingston Harbor Pier. By a cruel irony, she was traveling on the boat that was bringing the body of Parnell back to Ireland, an Ireland plunged into mourning for the dead leader. She was a magnificent figure, standing there alone, erect, dignified, swathed in black from head to toe. Her grief was for the dead child, but others, not knowing this, chose their own interpretations.
Would you look at the cut of her? Mad, gone, all drama as ever, in widow's weeds as if she'd known Parnell all her life. Can't resist making a show of herself. Ma's gone.
Ma's gone, if you ask me.
Maud!
Oh, Willie.
What can I say?
You're so good coming to meet me.
I'm so sorry.
He was only 19 months old, Willie.
Oh, come. I've got a cab waiting. We'll have breakfast in your hotel.
I'd give anything to have him back. Anything.
Do you believe death is the end of everything, Maud?
I don't know.
I don't.
I don't want to believe it.
Then don't.
Oh, if only I could see him again. Just one last look from him. One last smile for my little angel.
I believe you will see him again. If only you strive for it hard enough.
Will I? Is it possible?
There are ways, Maud. If you wish to follow the path of mystic revelation...
Will it mean I can see my angel again?
We can invoke his spirit. There are certain rituals and signs.
What do I have to do?
My dear, faithful Willie did his best to comfort me. He told me his study of the occult had convinced him that bodily death is not the end of existence, that out of death comes life, though perhaps in different forms. Next day I went alone to Parnell's funeral. Willie hated such things. And as Ireland's uncrowned king was lowered into the earth, I, along with others, saw the shooting star that crossed the sky at that moment. I took it as an omen that the cause of Ireland would rise again from the death of Parnell. Life out of death. What was not possible if one really believed in this?
She became very interested in my occult work and in my theosophist friends, even for a time avoiding all political activities. I felt it would be good for her to get away from the bitterness of politics, and I had plans that we too would devote our lives to the pursuit of mystic truth. We conjured up visions for ourselves that told of past lives. We talked of reincarnation, and she asked how soon could a child be reborn, and if reborn, where? A friend told her that it could be reborn into the same family, an answer that seemed to affect her greatly. However, gradually her old energy seemed to be returning, and with it her political involvement. And she began to be bored with our abstractions.
But really, Willie, your spiritualist friends are the essence of British middle-class smugness. An awful set. I really find them so tiresome.
Oh, they, like us, are on a quest for truth, Maud.
I don't care. They are an awful set. And as for this Order of the Golden Dawn we have joined, I'm afraid I'm going to have to resign. Far too Masonic for my liking.
But we agreed we would continue until we found reasons for your unhappiness, for your restless spirit.
No, I've made up my mind. I will do much more good taking up my work in Donegal where I left off. Real work amongst the poor.
And off she went. Back to the wilds of the west coast of Ireland. But soon her hard work took its toll. She was threatened with consumption. I was beside myself with worry. A pity beyond all telling is hid in the heart of love. The folk who are buying and selling, the clouds on their journey above, the cold wet winds ever blowing, and the shadowy hazel grove, where mouse-gray waters are flowing, threaten the head that I love.
I received Willie's sad and beautiful poem with some amusement. Far from dying, however, I was busier and my life more fulfilled than ever before.
Maud was indeed busy in France. She had embarked on a countrywide lecture tour. Standing before her audience, she was a magnificent presence, a Celtic druidess, her black eyes full of flame as she recounted the horrors of the Great Irish Famine of 1847.
Ireland was heroic in her suffering. Whole families, when they had eaten their last crust and understood that they had to die, looked once more upon the sun and then closed up the doors of their cabins with stones that none might look on their death agony. If you come to my country, every stone will repeat to you this tragic history. I have been told it by women who have heard the last sigh of their children without being able to relieve their agony with one drop of milk. It has seemed to me at evening, on those mountains of Ireland so full of savage majesty, when the wind sighed over the pits of the famine where thousands of dead enriched the harvests of the future, it has seemed to me that I heard an avenging voice calling down on our oppressors the execration of man and the justice of God.
But through all her frantic traveling and lecturing, the thought of the reincarnation of her baby never left her. One night in November 1893, in Samoa, she brought Lucien to the vault under the memorial chapel erected to little Georgie's memory.
Make love to me. Here. Now. On this spot. Oh, Lucien, please. Now. He will come back. I know he will. My darling boy will come back. Now. Now. Now.
Her daughter Iselt was born on the 6th of August, 1894.
Maud was now permanently resident in France, and though corresponding regularly, we saw little of each other over the next few years. By 1896, I was 30 years of age, unmarried and a virgin. And the pain of sexual desire rarely left me. Consequently, I decided to commence an affair with Mrs. Olivia Shakespeare. If I could not get the woman I loved, it would be a comfort, even for a while, to devote myself to another. But even though I never mentioned the matter to her, Maud had an intuitive awareness about this new relationship. She wrote to me of a dream she had had about me.
At a little before 12, I got into a half-waking, half-sleeping state. Then I saw you again, and together we went down to the cliffs at Hoth. But the seabirds were all asleep, and it was dark and so cold, and the wind blew so horribly.
I felt she sensed I was distancing myself from her. For our memories of our visit to Hoth had always been warm and loving ones. She continued.
Go on with the great work you are doing for Ireland by raising our literature. For the honor of our country, the world must recognize you as one of the great poets of the century. Be true to yourself and let nothing interfere with your literary work. That is surely your first duty. Do not let your life be tied down by other lesser ones.
In December 1896, I returned to Paris and to Maud. I had come to discuss with her the development of a castle of heroes where the finest men and women in Ireland would come for spiritual inspiration and teaching. I had even located such a castle in Loch Key in Roscommon. We were both interested in founding an Irish order of mysteries, though Maud's preoccupations tended to be more political than mystical. As in everything she did, she sought its relevance to her overriding wish of the separation of Ireland from English rule. I had hoped that with this unity of minds between us, she would eventually become mine. My gentle love, Olivia, meantime, became discomforted by this new contact with Maud, and our affair did not last long. Pale brows, still hands, and dim hair. I had a beautiful friend and dreamed that the old despair would end in love in the end. She looked in my heart one day and saw your image was there. She has gone weeping away.
1897 was the year of Queen Victoria's Jubilee. It was also the year that Irish nationalists began to organize 1798 centenary commemoration committees. And Willie, as much to impress Maud with his political credentials as anything else, became a member of the committee of the Wolfetone Memorial Association. Maud was back in the thick of it, making black flags embroidered with scenes of the famine and of the evictions. She spoke at a public meeting in Dame Street, organized by James Connolly's Socialist Party, railing against any celebration of Victoria, whom she called the Famine Queen. Willie, in the crowd below her, was enthralled by the power of her presence.
This morning, I went to St. Michael's Church to lay flowers on the hallowed tombs of the heroes of 1798 who lie there. But I could not do so. Why, you ask? I was told by the custodian there that I could not do it because it was the Queen's Jubilee. Must the graves of our dead go undecorated because Victoria has her Jubilee?
Her hold on that throng was extraordinary. Her power was unquestioned.
When the Centenary Committee met that evening, sounds from the workers' protest parade that Connolly had organized could be heard outside. The procession came along, led by a hand cart bearing a coffin on which were inscribed the words, "The British Empire."
Come, Willie. Let's join in. Come on.
Out there.
Listen to the band. Come on.
Wait, Maud. The crowd looks very excited. Do you think it's safe?
Safe?
I mean, is it wise?
Wise? What does anything matter when we have the people with us? The risen people. Forget wisdom for the moment, Willie. Now is not the time for discretion. Now is the time for action. Come on!
They joined in. Maud's black flags were displayed, and the Jubilee bunting was torn down by the passing throng. The police advanced with raised batons. Willie was greatly alarmed by the turn events were taking. Not so Maud.
Aren't you glad you're here, Willie, at this sacred hour? Aren't you glad to strike a blow for Ireland's freedom?
She was in her element and radiant. She strode along the darkened streets with a joyous face, exulting as the crowd stoned the windows of houses displaying jubilee decorations, her laughing head thrown back.
My God, we are living at a wondrous hour. This day, Ireland has redeemed herself. She has awoken from the long slumber of slavery. The famine queen will yet hear the voice of the poor.
I got caught up in her excitement. I stopped worrying whether I should try to stop the stoning. I gave myself up to the excitement of the moment, to the joyous irresponsibility and sense of power that Maud was experiencing. But later, my bravado faded when I learnt that one person had been killed in the rioting. Maud and I were sheltering in the National Club when word of the fatality reached us. Immediately, she made for the door into the street.
You're not going out there.
It's my place. With the people.
Oh, for God's sake, Maud.
Out of my way, please.
The people are being killed out there. I won't let you go.
Willie, I demand that you step aside from that door.
There. The door is locked, and I have the key.
Willie!
Please, Maud, it's for your own good.
You are making me do the only cowardly thing of my life. Open that door.
But I didn't. And she didn't speak to me for the rest of that evening. But friends such as we could not hold aloof forever, and our former intimacy was soon re-established.
This was a hectic time for Maud. During a six-month period beginning in April, she spoke several times in Paris, four times in Dublin, and at least once in London, York, Glasgow, Manchester, and Cork. In the autumn, Willie joined her on a lecture tour of Scotland and the Midlands, and during the long train journeys, they spent much time discussing political and mystical affairs. From Manchester, he wrote to a friend to say that Maud was
very kind and friendly, but whether more than that, I cannot say.
Soon after this tour, Maud set sail for America in October 1897. She was to lecture on Ireland and collect funds for the Wolfetone Memorial Committee. She made such an impression there that as a parting gift, the Irish-American women of Brooklyn presented her with an embossed and framed resolution of gratitude, thanking
Ireland's Joan of Arc for abandoning a charming home, devoted friends, and high social position in order to disseminate the doctrine of union and independence among the scattered children of Erin.
On returning from America, Maud and I set off together for the west of Ireland. And it was our purpose to make contact with the mystical forces in the land.
Oh, do hurry, Willie. It'll be dark before we reach the cairn at this pace.
I'm coming.
Just another few hundred feet to the top. You can do it.
Oh, I will. But let's just rest for a bit.
Oh, Willie.
Oh, please, Maud.
Lazy bones. Oh, just for a minute, mind.
Yes. Yes, just a minute. Well, that's better.
And you are the one who is always lecturing me about my cigarette smoking. Look at you. You're puffing like a train.
Yes, well, remember, you have had practice up and down those Donegal hills. Anyway, I do think you push yourself too hard, Maud.
Oh, nonsense.
You should take more care of yourself. Well, those coughing attacks you have.
Oh, don't fuss, Willie.
Oh, I do worry about you, you know.
It's really very sweet of you, but you mustn't. Here, sit closer to me and enjoy the view. Oh, perfectly wonderful, isn't it?
Yes, perfectly wonderful.
Willie, stop that. Look at the view, please.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, breathtaking, isn't it? The mountains, the sea, the sun setting behind the islands. Oh, it's a country worth dying for, isn't it?
Even more worth living for, Maud.
Doesn't it make you feel so close to the soul of Ireland? A place like this?
Oh, yes, indeed. One can feel the old gods very near in a place such as this.
Out there. Look. Where? Out over the sea. That sunbeam slanting from the cloud. That could well be the spear of the great god Lu.
Yes. Maud. Maud, listen. In the wind. In the wind. Can't you hear it?
What?
That music.
Music? Oh, yes. Yes, I hear it. Where's it coming from?
Here. Here, listen.
Where?
It's coming from the ground. Oh, listen.
Yes. Yes, Willie. I can hear. I can hear.
It's the soul of Ireland calling out to us.
That sunbeam. This. It's a sign, Willie. Lou is protecting us. No harm can befall while we are under the protection of Lou's spear.
Mort. Mort. We are blessed at this moment.
And forever.
And she needed those blessings for the work that lay ahead of her. No sooner had we returned from the west of Ireland, me to London and she to Paris, than she was back again, but to Mayo this time. James Connolly had asked her to investigate the near-famine conditions there, which the British government was anxious to cover up. But first, I met her briefly in London, and I accompanied her to Liverpool, where she would get the boat to Dublin. On the way, I opened my heart to her, telling of the pain of my love for her, my hopes for the future. She said little in reply, but later wrote to me from Dublin.
My dear friend, it was very pleasant seeing you in London and Liverpool. But you must think very well what is best for your genius. That should be your first consideration. If you find that an absolutely platonic friendship, which is all I can or ever will be able to give, unsettles you and spoils your work, then you must have the strength and courage at once to give up meeting me. You owe your genius to Ireland. It belongs to Ireland. You have no right to allow anything to injure it.
I wander by the edge of this desolate lake, where wind cries in the sedge, until the axle break that keeps the stars in their round, and hands hurl in the deep the banners of east and west, and the girdle of light is unbound. Your breast will not lie by the breast of your beloved in sleep.
In Mayo, Maud, with her energy and her willingness to take direct action, stopped a disaster virtually single-handed. She bought oatmeal and condensed milk out of her own pocket and set the women to cooking and distributing porridge. Together with the parish priest, she drew up a list of minimum demands to be presented to the local board of guardians. She addressed a mass meeting of 10,000 starving people in Belmullet.
I am determined that the people should rouse themselves and not die as in 1847. Not go meekly into the graves which England has prepared for you. I urge you men to take the law into your own hands and take the landlord's sheep off the hills. It is no sin for a starving man to take from him who has plenty. You will be cowards if you allow your children to die rather than fall foul of England's laws. I am going now to present your demands to the Board of Guardians, now in session in the courthouse over there. They must know you are behind me. There are only 20 police constables here. There are 10,000 of you. Let those inside see that you are serious, determined, steadfast, that this time you will fight rather than die.
And she won. The Board of Guardians acceded to her demands.
You have won these small things by your numbers and by your united strength. By your strength and courage, you must win the freedom of Ireland.
In December, Maud and I met in Dublin, and I told her of a strange dream I had just had. I dreamed last night that we kissed on the lips for the first time.
Oh, strange. I had a similar dream.
Really?
Well, it
was more of an experience than a dream. I went out of my body and was taken away by the god Lu. He put my hand in yours, and he said that we were married. An astral marriage. Then I kissed you, and everything went dark.
At that, she leaned forward. And there and then, for the first time, with bodily mouth, she kissed me.
It was to seal our astral marriage. But when I saw the look on his face, I realized what I had done and I apologized. I saw that the time had now come to be perfectly frank with him.
And then it all came out. Her secret life in Paris with Millevoye. Her children. She said that she no longer lived with him, but that he needed her. I pressed her, telling her that I thought she was held by a sense of duty. But she still insisted that marriage was impossible for her, as she had a horror and a terror of physical love. She begged me not to think of her that way. It would indeed be better if I did not love her, she said. But then what choice had I? I whispered, I am too young. And then, I am old enough. Wherefore I threw a penny to find out if I might love. Go and love. Go and love, young man, if the lady be young and fair. Ah, penny, brown penny, brown penny. I am looped in the loops of her hair. In January 1899, I went to Paris and again asked Maud to marry me. I wanted to protect her, to dissuade her from the life of political intrigue and hatred she had embarked on. I knew she was still politically linked with Millevoye and with other French politicians and intriguers. I implored her to give herself up to the divine love between us that we had so long talked about. She would not relent. A few days later, she wrote to me.
My dear Willie, all I want of you is not to build up an imaginary wall of effort between yourself and life. For the rest, the gods will arrange. For you are one of those they have chosen to do their work. As for the possible danger which you speak of for me, I am under the shield of our great god Lu. The day I am no longer protected, if that day comes, my work for Ireland will be over. I should not need and could not accept protection from anyone, though I fully realize and understand the generous and unselfish thoughts which were in your heart, and I love you for them. I am in my whirlwind, but in the midst of that whirlwind is a dead calm which is peace, too. Always your friend, Maud Gonne.
The outbreak of the Boer War threw Maud into yet another ferment of activity. She campaigned to stop Irishmen being recruited into the British Army, urging instead that they join the Irish Brigade, being formed by Major John McBride, to fight on the side of the Boers. To her, the issue was straightforward.
It matters not to the Irish people whether the republics are right or wrong. The fact that they are fighting England makes us their friend.
To my distress, Maud's nationalism grew more violent, and I suffered from my association with her. However, my own nationalist convictions, while lagging far behind, were enough to have me excluded from many's the comfortable unionist drawing room. Kind friends advised me to distance myself, but I could not. Those who really knew me, and who thought they knew my feelings for Maud, hinted gently that time would deliver me from my obsession. One that is ever kind said yesterday, your well-beloved's hair has threads of grey, and little shadows come about her eyes. Time can but make it easier to be wise. though now it seems impossible, and so all that you need is patience. Heart cries, no, I have not a crumb of comfort, not a grain. Time can but make her beauty over again. Because of that great nobleness of hers, the fire that stirs about her when she stirs burns but more clearly. Oh, she had not these ways when all the wild summer was in her gaze. Oh, heart, if she'd but turn her head, you'd know the folly of being comforted.
As the war approached its end, the Irish Brigade disbanded, and Major John McBride, the Irish hero who could not return to Ireland or England because of his treasonable activities, arrived in Paris. At the Gare de Lyon, he was given a hero's welcome by Maud and fellow Irish émigrés. In her anti-recruiting speeches, she had frequently praised John McBride for having saved Ireland's honor. Now she was to meet the great man for the first time.
He was much as I had imagined him. A military bearing, a devil-may-care demeanor. He was every inch a man of action. Later, we had dinner at my flat, and we talked all through the night. I smoked one cigarette after the other as I hung on his every word. Here was an Irishman who had actually engaged the British forces, who had captured British guns and British flags. Here was a living, breathing hero at last.
I had heard of her association with McBride, and I was uneasy for her. However, I felt she would soon tire of his shallow charms and send him on his way. I was progressing with my work for the theatre. My play, Kathleen Na Hoolain, was finished, and I promised Maud that I would give it to her Daughters of Erin theatrical group, provided that she herself would play Kathleen. After all, it was only fitting that the woman who inspired the work, who personified for me all that was noble and courageous in Irish womanhood, should take the title role.
I told Willie this play was wonderful. It was everything I had longed for and indeed expected from Willie's genius. I was to be Ireland herself in the guise of an old woman visiting a poor country cottage in the west of Ireland at the time of the 1798 rising, when the French had just landed to support the Irish insurgents.
At the start of the evening, Maud caused a sensation by typically defying all theatrical tradition with a dramatic entrance striding through the hushed auditorium. And when at last she spoke, it seemed to all present as if Ireland herself spoke.
It is a hard service they take that help me. Many that are red-cheeked now will be pale-cheeked. Many that have been free to walk the hills and the bogs and the rushes will be sent to walk hard streets in far countries. Many a good plan will be broken. Many that have gathered money will not stay to spend it. Many a child will be born and there will be no father at its christening to give it a name. They that had red cheeks will have pale cheeks for my sake. And for all of that, they will think they are well paid. They shall be remembered forever. They shall be alive forever. They shall be speaking forever. The people shall hear them forever.
The old woman goes out, and influenced by her words, the son of the house, who is to be married in the morning, rushes out after her to join in the rising. His father asks a younger son who has just come in, did he see an old woman going down the path? The boy replies, I did not, but I saw a young girl, and she had the walk of a queen. At this, Maud flung off the cloak of the bent old woman and drew herself up to her full height. The effect was electric, and the audience gasped.
Maud Gonne, to many people, was to be Kathleen Na Hoolain forevermore.
but we have hidden in our hearts the flame out of the eyes of Kathleen, the daughter of Hulan.
After the great success of the play, Maud returned to Paris and John McBride. Rumors began to circulate.
I heard these rumors and discounted them. However, on a whim, I wrote to Maud, telling her under no circumstances should she consider marrying McBride, or anyone come to that. She should not abandon her proud, solitary, haughty life.
On the 21st of February, 1903, in her 37th year, Maud married John McBride in Paris.
Never give all the heart for love will hardly seem worth thinking of to passionate women if it seem certain and they never dream that it fades out from kiss to kiss. For everything that's lovely is but a brief, dreamy, kind delight. Oh, never give the heart outright. For they, for all smooth lips can say, have given their hearts up to the play. And who could play it well enough, if deaf and dumb and blind with love? He that made this knows all the cost, for he gave all his heart and lost.
Poor Willie got her telegram just as he was about to deliver a lecture, and remembered nothing of the rest of that day.
Sweetheart, do not love too long. I loved long and long, and grew to be out of fashion, like an old song. All through the years of our youth, neither could have known their own thought from the others. We were so much as one. But, oh, in a minute she changed. Oh, do not love too long, or you will grow out of fashion, like an old song.
In May, Maud and Willie met in London. It was their first meeting since her wedding. She went up to him and took his hands.
Are we still friends?
Maud, I'll always be your friend.
Can you forgive me then?
You know I love you, Maud.
But can you forgive me?
Forgiveness doesn't come into it. I love you. And that's that.
Willie.
I can be angry, disappointed. It doesn't stop me loving you.
Oh, Willie.
It's my affliction, Maud. There's nothing to be done. No cure.
Dear Willie, I don't deserve you. I don't. If only I'd listened.
Listened?
To you. To everybody. Oh, Willie.
Maud. Maud, what is it?
You were right. You were right. I should never have married.
Then she told me what I and many others already knew, had always known, that her marriage to McBride had been a terrible mistake. I saw the distress she was in and did not wish to add to it with the burden of my own sorrows. I told her I still loved her, would always love her. I promised to help her in any way I could.
Willie was so understanding, and his caring was a great comfort to me. He was a rock of stability at the center of my hectic life. It enabled me to forget my troubles and get on with my work for Ireland. And there was plenty of that to be tackled. The new English king, Edward VII, was planning to visit Dublin. I was determined that he should get the same frosty reception his mother got. The daughters of Erin covered the town with posters protesting against the visit. We made sure that there wasn't a post or gable wall unadorned. But still, when I went home to Coulson Avenue, I was annoyed. I felt we should have done more. The street was ablaze with red, white, and blue, with a Union Jack poking out of every first-floor window. Every window but mine. The Pope had just died, someone who commanded more respect from the people than any English king, yet nowhere was there any recognition of the fact.
I decided to remedy the situation.
My God! Would you look at what that mad gone woman has sticking out of her window?
Is it a flag or what?
It's a black petticoat on the end of a brush.
Isn't that a shocking thing in a Christian country?
The king's visit proved so uneventful that the bored journalists, looking for some newsworthy items, gave Maud's antics much more publicity than they deserved. I must say I did not wholly approve of such flamboyance, but it was quite in tune with her personality. I subsequently went to America on a lecture tour, and Maud returned to Paris and her marriage. She was 5 months pregnant. In November, I heard a painful rumor that McBride was drinking. It was the last touch of tragedy, if it was true. My dear is angry that of late I cry all base blood down, as if she had not taught me hate by kisses, by a clown.
On the 26th of January, 1904, my beloved little boy, Sean, my golden-haired jewel, was born. He was the one consolation in my disintegrating marriage. John was drinking and abusive. Such a change in such a short time. Or was it that I had just not noticed, despite all the warnings from those that loved me, of a hero I had made? Nothing now remained, and the disillusion was cruel.
In the following year, she filed for divorce, an action that divided the nationalist movement. Some felt Maud had been wronged. Others were convinced that she was casting a slur on a national hero. 10 years of exile in Paris were to follow. Willie visited her a lot. In 1908, he again mentioned marriage. All she offered was a renewal of their spiritual union.
She believed that this bond would be recreated and would be the means of spiritual illumination between us. It was to be the bond of spirit only. And she lives from now, she said, for that and for her children. At nights, in our separate countries, we invoked the other's presence. In July, she wrote to me of one such experience.
Last night, all my household had retired at 11:15, and I thought I would go to you astrally. We went somewhere in space, I don't know where. I was conscious of starlight and of hearing the sea below us. You had taken the form, I think, of a great serpent, though I'm not quite sure. I only saw your face distinctly, and as I looked into your eyes, as I did the day in Paris, you asked me what I was thinking of, and your lips touched mine. We melted into one another till we formed one being, a being greater than ourselves, who felt and knew all with double intensity. The clock striking 11 broke the spell, and as we separated, it felt as if life was being drawn away from me through my chest with almost physical pain. Then I went upstairs to bed, and I dreamed of you, confused dreams of ordinary life. We were in Italy together. We were quite happy, and we talked of this wonderful spiritual vision I have described. You said it would tend to increase physical desire. This troubles me a little, for there was nothing physical in that union. Material union is but a pale shadow compared to it.
Friends pointed out the fruitlessness of my passion, the passing years of frustration, the waste of spirit in pursuit of one who moved beyond the bounds of respectable society. But no one realized this more than myself, and no one gloried more in the wreckage. Why should I blame her that she filled my days with misery, or that she would of late have taught to ignorant men most violent ways, or hurled the little streets upon the great? Had they but courage equal to desire? What could have made her peaceful with a mind that nobleness made simple as a fire? With beauty like a tightened bow, a kind that is not natural in an age like this,
being high and solitary and most stern. Why, what could she have done being what she is? Was there another Troy for her to burn?
No matter how much Maud lauded their astral unions, and no matter how much Willie concurred with her enthusiasm, he still remained tortured with physical desire for her.
Come. Come, Willie. Come and talk in here. We won't disturb the children's sleep in here.
I glimpsed Isolde at the turn of the stairs, shepherding young Sean up to bed. She looked very grown up. What age is she now?
14, and quite the lady. Oh. I see young men looking at her already.
She will certainly be a beauty.
You think so?
Like her mother.
Oh, I'm not sure it's such a good thing to wish beauty on someone. It carries its own responsibilities.
Cheerfully born, I should imagine.
Oh, you laugh, but it's true, Willie.
It's easy for the beautiful to say such a thing. Could you convince a plain woman of your burden? I think not.
Oh, let's stop talking about such things. Here, Willie, have a brandy. We'll need your sleep tonight for that awful journey back to Dublin facing you. How often I've done it myself.
Thanks, Maud. She is very like you, you know.
She's a willful child. We have that in common.
She makes me sad.
Sad, Willie? Why?
You won't want to hear me say it.
Why not?
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I mentioned it.
Willie?
Please, forget I spoke.
Tell me, Willie. Please. Please, Willie.
She could have been our child.
Willie.
There, I've said it.
Oh, Willie, don't.
No, I know. It's just...
Willie, dearest, your beautiful poems are our children.
So you keep telling me.
Isn't it true?
Maud.
Willie, now listen, dearest. You and I are both 43. For half our lifetimes, we have known each other. And we have known that such a thing could never be.
You have known him, Maud.
But, Willie...
Maud, I love you.
And I you.
I ache for you. I hurt. I am in pain for you.
Willie, dearest, don't.
I am in pain.
Dearest.
Please. Please. Hold me, Maud.
Oh, there. Don't hurt my love.
Oh, how I have yearned to have your arms about me.
There, my poor boy. There.
Oh my darling.
No.
Oh, my love.
My sweet.
Oh, my darling. My darling.
In old age, he would remember this moment.
The women take so little stock in what I do or say, they'd sooner leave the cosseting to hear a jackass bray. My arms are like the twisted thorn, and yet their beauty lay. The first of all the tribe lay there, and did such pleasure take. She who had brought great Hector down and put all Troy to wreck, that she cried into this ear, strike me if I shriek.
But no sooner had he left her than she wrote to him, regretting what had passed between them.
Dearest, you asked me yesterday if I am not a little sad that things are as they are between us. I am sorry, and I am glad. It is hard being away from each other so much. But, beloved, I am glad and proud beyond measure of your love, and that it is strong enough and high enough to accept the spiritual love and union I offer. I have prayed so hard to have all earthly desire taken from my love for you. And, dearest, loving you as I do, I have prayed, and I am praying still, that the bodily desire for me be taken from you too. I know how hard and rare a thing it is for a man to hold spiritual love when the bodily desire is gone. And I have not made these prayers without a terrible struggle that shook my life, though I do not speak much of it. You have loved generously and unselfishly as few men have loved. It is what remains to me out of the wreck of life, what I can take with me into the peace of the sanctuary. Our children were your poems, of which I was the father, sowing the unrest and storm which made them possible. And you were the mother who brought them forth in suffering and in the highest beauty. And our children had wings.
The outbreak of the Great War trapped Maud and her family in France. Unable to involve herself in events in Ireland, she and Isolde volunteered for hospital work, and they were nursing the casualties of the Battle of Verdun when the first news of the Easter Rising in Dublin reached them in April 1916. Willie had sent them the Irish newspapers.
I have met them at close of day, coming with vivid faces from counter or desk among grey 18th century houses. I have passed with a nod of the head or polite, meaningless words, or have lingered a while and said polite, meaningless words, and thought before I had done of a mocking tale or a jibe to please a companion around the fire at the club, being certain that they and I but lived where motley is worn. All changed, changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born.
Dear Willie, thank you for your letter and the paper. I am overwhelmed by the tragedy and the greatness of the sacrifice our countrymen and women have made. They have raised the Irish cause again to a position of tragic dignity. They have made it impossible to ignore Ireland or to say that she is satisfied at the conference where at the end of the war much will be heard about the rights of small nations. On Sunday morning, I read in the papers the announcement of Major MacBride's execution. I called Isolt and Sean and told them that although he did not behave well to us, he had died for his country, and now we can think of him with honor. I am told his last moments were heroic. He refused the blindfold, saying that he had faced British guns before.
This other man I had dreamed, a drunken, vainglorious lout, he had done most bitter wrong to some who are near my heart. Yet I number him in the song. He, too, has resigned his part in the casual comedy. He, too, has been changed in his turn, transformed utterly. A terrible beauty is born.
At Little Sean's school at Passy, a roll of honor is called every morning of pupils' relatives who have been killed in the war. Major MacBride's name has now been added to that list. He died for Ireland, and his son will bear an honored name. I remember nothing else.
And what if excess of love bewildered them till they died? I write it out in a verse. MacDonagh and MacBride, and Connolly and Pierce, now and in time to be, wherever green is worn, are changed, changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born.
Maud was now a widow and free to remarry, and Willie's hopes rose yet again. Isolt, who was a French passport holder, was free to travel, visited Willie in London. She brought him news that Maud was very sad and lonely and was sleeping badly. Isolt was now a very beautiful young woman of 20, and he was much impressed with her.
She looked very distinguished and was now full of self-possession. She was beautifully dressed, though very plainly. I said, "Why are you so pale?" And she said, "Too much responsibility." She made me sad, for I thought that if my life had been normal, I might have had a daughter of her age. In August, I went back to Normandy with her and found Maud in a joyous and self-forgetting condition of political hate, the like of which I had not till then encountered. She was now 50, but the passion of her commitments had not dimmed from what it had been 30 years before. Yet again I tentatively mentioned marriage to her, but she only half heard me. So absorbed was she in her plans for Ireland.
It is essential that work for the families of the internees be commenced immediately. Their fathers and sons and brothers have all been marched off to camps in England and Wales, and... What was that you said, Willie? As soon as I obtain a passport, the children and I will return to Dublin. And I will call a meeting of...
Maud!
Yes?
Maud, will you promise me that you will give up this political work? You have done enough.
Give up?
You could have such a beautiful life with me, amongst writers and painters. You could work for Ireland in a different way, Maud. You are not made for smoke-filled rooms, for batten charges, for the baying of the mob.
Willie, I know what I was made for. I was made for Ireland.
Maud, will you marry me?
Willie, of course not.
Well, then, have I your permission to ask Isolde to marry me?
Isolde? You mean it? Yes. Yes, you may, though be warned. I doubt if she will take you seriously.
Lady Gregory had said that Isolde, though very young, would be a much more suitable wife for me than her mother, as she was uninterested in politics and very interested in literature. I decided to act.
Mother! Mother, you'll never guess. I've just been proposed to.
Dear Willie, he said he would. He proposed to me again yesterday.
Isolde had mixed emotions. She was amused, then honored, then moved at this proposal from her mother's longtime suitor. She enjoyed the summer flirtation, but in the end, she refused him. At that, Willie came back to London and proposed to me. And I accepted him.
I first met Georgie Hydelees in 1911 at the house of a mutual acquaintance. We met infrequently over the intervening years, and our friendship had grown with time. She brought into my life a serenity and order I could never have known with Maud. In January 1918, Maud, who had been forbidden to enter Ireland, arrived in Dublin in disguise. She bought a house in Stephen's Green and began her political activities again. Ireland was very tense. Sinn Féin was contesting by-elections amid heated arguments about home rule and the imminence of conscription. I hoped she would not get so involved again. I appealed to her not to. Although I was now married, my vision of her was undimmed, her imperfections merely adding to her beauty. You are more beautiful than any one, and yet your body had a flaw. Your small hands were not beautiful, and I am afraid that you will run and paddle to the wrist in that mysterious, always brimming lake where those that have obeyed the holy law paddle and are perfect. Leave unchanged the hands that I have kissed, for old sake's sake. A few months later, the British authorities arrested the leadership of Sinn Féin and deported 73 people to Britain on the pretext of a German plot. Poor Maud was arrested with them and ended up in Holloway Prison, incarcerated in the VD clinic of all places. While there, she learned of the death of her French lover, Millevoye, and shortly after, her sister Kathleen died. She became so seriously depressed that I and her relatives used every bit of influence we had to get her released. Once released, she was off again, agitating for political prisoners' rights.
Willie's life was now calm and wonderfully domestic. Our daughter Anne was born in February 1919. Shortly afterwards, Willie wrote a prayer for my daughter. In it, he wished his child would never resemble the one woman he had loved so hopelessly for 30 years.
An intellectual hatred is the worst. So let her think opinions are accursed. Have I not seen the loveliest woman born out of the mouth of plenty's horn? Because of her opinionated mind, barter that horn and every good by quiet natures understood for an old bellows full of angry wind.
Through the Anglo-Irish War, the trauma of the treaty negotiations, and the civil war that followed, Maud was in the throes of every protest and agitation. There was no more bitter enemy of the treaty and of the partitioned Ireland it created than she. Her own son, Sean, having joined the IRA, was now a prisoner of the new Irish government. Maud formed the Women's Prisoners Defense League. This became the focus of her life. But with Willie, things were very different. He, like many others, was weary of the never-ending fighting and turmoil and longed for stability.
How can I, that girl standing there, my attention fix on Roman or on Russian or on Spanish politics? Yet here's a traveled man that knows what he talks about. And there's a politician that has read and thought. And maybe what they say is true of war and war's alarms. But oh, that I were young again and held her in my arms.
Increasingly, he identified with the emerging state, becoming one of its first senators, a smiling public man, as he put it, a fact which infuriated Maud. As political events took a more violent turn, the new government began arresting Republicans who were still fighting against partition. Among these latter was Maud, who now entered her second term of imprisonment in Kilmainham Jail in January 1923.
The day before she was arrested, she wrote to say that if I did not denounce the government, she would renounce my society forever.
We quarreled seriously when he agreed to become a senator of the Free State. I told him, for your poetry you will be forgiven, but sin no more.
Immediately she was arrested, Maud had gone on hunger strike. I wrote to Mr. Cosgrave, the Prime Minister, urging her release and pointing out her previous work for the country and that she was now 57 years of age and had always suffered from poor health. My plea had some success. The new government could not afford to let the wife of John McBride die. After 20 days, she was carried from the prison on a stretcher to the cheers of her supporters thronging the streets outside.
Willie and I had drifted apart. It was plain we would never agree on political matters. We were having the same disagreements that we argued about in our early 20s. We met in frequency now, usually for dinner, and politics was not mentioned. Increasingly, I found myself disappointed in his conversation. With politics off the agenda, he would try to entertain me with stories of the bright young people, usually young women, that he knew in London. But I did not care for his butterfly talk. It was so out of character. Only in our written correspondence did we ever now touch on serious matters. My dear Willie, oh, how you hate old age. Well, so do I. I see no redeeming features in it. But I, who am more a rebel against man than you, rebel less against nature and accept the inevitable and go with it gently into the unknown. Only against the sordidness and cruelty of small ambitions I fight until the long rest comes.
And she did fight. She even had the energy to carry on quarreling with Willie.
Where had her sweetness gone? What fanatics invent in this blind, bitter town? Fantasy or incident, not worth thinking of, put her in a rage. I had forgiven enough that had forgiven old age.
But by now, he no longer had the energy for arguments. While he could not share Mo's republicanism, he continued to admire, often despite himself, her commitment to it.
Out of Ireland have we come. Great hatred, little room, maimed us at the start. I carry from my mother's womb a fanatic heart.
His health was deteriorating, but he was writing his verses with as great an intensity as ever.
Maud gone at host station waiting a train, Pallas Athene in that straight back and arrogant head, all the Olympians a thing never known again.
In the summer of 1936, Maud visited Willie at our home under the Dublin Mountains. It was to be their last meeting.
As we said goodbye, he, sitting in his armchair, from which he could rise only with great effort, said,
"Oh, we should have gone on with our castle of the heroes. We might still do it."
I was so surprised that he remembered, I could not reply. I stood speechless beside him with the song of Red Hanrahan echoing through my mind. The wind has bundled up the clouds high over Knocknarea and thrown the thunder on the stones for all that Maeve can say. Angers that are like noisy clouds have set our hearts abeat. But we have all bent low and low and kissed the quiet feet of Kathleen, the daughter of Houlihan.
Shortly afterwards, in January 1939, Willie died while staying in the south of France. Because of the war, his body was not brought back to Ireland until 1949. Maud's son, Sean McBride, then a minister in the Irish government, was responsible for the state burial in Willie's adored Sligo. Maud was too weak to attend the ceremony. She described herself as a prisoner of old age, waiting for release. A release which came at last in 1953, when she was 86 years old. The lover and the beloved were together at last.
The yellow pool has overflowed high up on Clusnabare, for the wet winds are blowing out of the clinging air. Like heavy flooded waters, our bodies and our blood, but purer than a tall candle before the holy rood, is Kathleen, the daughter of Houlihan.
The world will thank me was written by J.P. Rooney, with Barbara Brennan as Maud Gonne and Dan Gordon as W.B. Yeats. Susan Slott was George, Katrina Hines was Isiut, and Amanda Maguire was the Dublin woman. The music was composed and performed by Neil Martin. The World Will Thank Me was directed in Belfast by Pam Brighton.